Simon Maxwell, Senior Research Associate at ODI. Simon, we're at the CAPE 2012 conference on development cooperation in tomorrow's world. You've been part of that conference. I've seen you on the edge of your seat on a couple of occasions looking to respond to some of the comments which have been made. I saw one particular on climate finance. Can you tell us what you were thinking at that moment?
Well, you know, I completely accept, buy into, and have been a proponent of the idea that development cooperation has to change. And I talk about having the same mission statement for development cooperation, but a new job description, because we all believe in poverty reduction and human development and so on, but we're going to be doing different things in the future in new ways. You know, as we have the conversation, and especially in a conference like this, people use stylized facts a lot. They kind of have memorable things you might know about the aid system. And some of those are right, and some of them are actually rather deeply misleading. I think there's a stylized fact, for example, that climate finance is very different to old-style aid because it deals much more with the private sector. In the climate field, we talk a lot about blending loans and grants, about incentivizing the private sector, using risk instruments, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, we do a lot of that as well in aid, and there's a long tradition. For example, the Commonwealth Development Corporation, CDC, or the IFC of the World Bank, working with the private sector, taking equity stakes in businesses, the IFC, and making sure that we find some way to, at the lowest cost possible, incentivize the private sector. So I think there's a real convergence there between aid and climate finance. There are a couple of other of these stylized facts that have had me on the edge of my seat. One is the idea that you can divide aid into two categories. There's country programmable aid, and there is everything else. And the only one that matters is country programmable aid, which is made available to the government that they can put in their budget. I think that's a really important distinction to make if you're working on issues like budget support and how to provide large-scale program aid to countries. But it kind of implies that other forms of aid are worthless. And the other forms of aid include humanitarian aid, absolutely vital for protecting lives, but also actually for investing in resilience and helping people to bridge relief and development. It also implies that technical assistance is somehow almost immoral, is unnecessary and inappropriate. And of course it's true that that puts the money back into the sending country rather than the receiving country. But some of the best aid is often technical assistance. You know, I remember somebody saying to me once that in Zambia, the best single aid project ever was paying the salary of an advisor to the governor of the central bank. Technical assistance, but it actually made macroeconomic stability in Zambia easier. There are some other big stylized facts about the growing importance of the philanthropic sector. It's very important to have those numbers right to make sure that we don't include, for example, lots of cultural aid or aid to Israel, which is for religious purposes. But there are some things you can do with philanthropic aid and some things you can't. I've asked in the past, why doesn't Melinda, this is about the Gates Foundation, why doesn't Melinda make motorways and build bridges? They don't. They do other things. They do health and education and so on. So we can't assume that the rise of philanthropic aid and peer-to-peer giving is going to be going to substitute perfectly for traditional aid. I'm really in favour of the debate. This is a great conference. But when we use stylized facts, let's use them carefully.
And your comment on climate finance reflects some of the importance which has been placed on those issues in the discussions over the last day or so. That's just one part, and you touched briefly on another, philanthropy of an emerging aid architecture, which is up for discussion. What's your overview on how the aid architecture is changing?
There are a couple of things to say about that. First of all, aid is going to be under pressure. And it may also be the case that traditional aid is less needed. And here's one of the issues that I worry about a lot, that we're going to say that middle-income countries don't need aid. In fragile states, it's really difficult to spend aid. And then there is a small number of kind of not fragile, low-income countries, and we're going to pile into those countries, and we may run into real problems of absorptive capacity. I often say there are three kinds of countries. There are middle-income countries that don't need aid. There are fragile states where we can't spend aid. And there's Malawi. And we know that if you try to provide more than, sometimes as much as 40%, but that's a high estimate of aid as a share of GNP to developing countries, they run into serious problems of absorptive capacity. if we find that we don't need as much aid for the low-income countries as we traditionally think we have, then we're going to find some difficulty in maintaining public support for 0.7. And that raises very difficult and important issues about the extent to which we count climate finance and aid for other global public goods as aid. Historically, we've always argued for additionality of climate finance. And I think at the moment that is still the right thing to do. The previous government in the UK set a limit of 10% of aid that could be used for climate purposes. If we lift that limit, and many countries are doing so, then we may find that all the aid that we have available is gobbled up by climate finance. And the risk is that we are taking money away from young mothers and children in Burkina Faso and giving it to producers of solar panels in a country like China.
And talking about tomorrow's world, 10, 20 years' time, in your view, where should aid and development cooperation be? How should we have evolved in that time?
Well, I'm clear in my mind that whatever happens to traditional aid to low-income countries, there will be a large and growing need for international action to deal with a set of global public bads, starting with climate, but lots of others, including global disease threats and crime and drugs and terrorism and security and so on and so forth. We're going to need cooperation to deal with those, and we're going to need money to help deal with them, either directly or as part of a negotiation with developing countries. There are a couple of features then of the international development system that follow from that observation. The first is that the solutions to global problems are necessarily multilateral. We've often made a case against the proliferation of bilateral agencies and funds and programs simply on the grounds of the transactions costs for developing countries. But there's a new argument for multilateralism, which is that you're not going to be able to deal with climate on a country-by-country basis. We need the global deals. We need the multilateral institutions, whether it's the UN or the World Bank or the WTO, the UNFCCC on climate, for example. So the people working in aid in the future will be necessarily looking to the multilateral system at least as much as they are to the bilateral system. And that has big implications for the organisation of agencies and for the staffing of agencies, and I've written about that quite a bit in the past as well. We will still need people who understand about how villages work in the poorest countries and about social relationships and so on, but we're also going to need a lot of people who know much more about how the international system works and how to broker global deals. I remember once speaking to a group of social anthropologists and saying that you have extraordinary expertise in the marriage customs of tribal communities in Bangladesh. What we're going to need in the future is similar expertise applied to the marriage customs of members of the General Assembly, because that's where the focus will be of our development work in the future.
Simon Maxwell, thank you.
Very good.